Well, good morning. I'm subbing for Joe. Today we're talking about the letters to the churches. The formation of the New Testament came to be known as the canon, not the firing canon, but the collection of materials. Just to give you a sense of the timeline, Jesus, sometime around 33 AD or CE, that's common era, you'll find that in non-church scholarly materials. The late 40s to mid 50s, you had the formation of the churches. 50s plus, all the way up to the hundreds and beyond, you had the letters to the churches. And then after the letters to the churches, the Gospels. We don't often think of that because in our Bibles we find the Gospels first, which makes sense because the New Testament is something of a, it is a biography of Jesus followed by commentary. So in terms of written form and reading form, it makes sense to have the story of Jesus before you have the unpacking of what it means. And then the canon came much later as councils of the churches argued about things that were heretical, things that were not, figuring out things like exactly how was Jesus like God, were they of a similar substance or were they the same substance. I'm sure they were very exciting meetings to sit through, at least parts of them. One thing to think about is the letters that Paul wrote and others wrote to the churches, we call them books, but really they're letters. One way you can think about it is a lengthy email. I mean, some of these books in the epistles are not very long, but I mean, that's really what we're talking about is Paul, early on, was interpreting the life of Jesus and developing theology and sent these communications to the church. Some of them, how many of you are old enough to remember chain letters? How many of you still participate in chain letters? Okay. So for those of you that might not be familiar, my mother-in-law still does it. She's got like friends in the eastern half of the United States, and they send these circular letters. So you write a portion, send it to the next person on the list, they write a portion. So some of these letters were kind of like circulars. We're talking about large amount of illiteracy, certainly pre-printing, these things would have been handwritten. So there might have been copies made. But I don't think that when Paul was writing these letters that he was necessarily thinking, oh, these are going to become the official documents of the church bound together and are going to be the commentary that people are going to look to hereafter for understanding the Gospels. I mean, these were pastoral letters. God forbid my email communications would become canon. It's that kind of thing. But, you know, when you're writing it out by hand, you do take a little time to make sure it's the final draft. No whiteout in those areas. What's that?
Chuck's emails are...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So conference minister weekly emails. I can't imagine that Chuck Neufeld would ever think that those would become scripture. Just to give you a sense of further timeline, conversion of Paul would have been around 35. First missionary journeys around would have been 48 to 49. The Council of Jerusalem would have been around 50. That was where they debated whether Gentiles could become part of the Jesus way without being circumcised. That was a huge one. And then we have the formation of the churches. Corinth, to whom the book of Corinthians, the letter of Corinthians, was written, formed in 51 to 52. The letter written around 55. Churches of Galatia founded 48 to 49. Letter written, some say 49, some say mid-50s. The church at Ephesus, AD 54. Letter written 60 to 62. Church at Philippi, 51. Letter written 60 to 62. Church at Colossae, founded AD 54. Letter written 60 to 62. Thessalonica, formed 51, written 51. 2 Thessalonians, written shortly after. And then we get into Timothy and those letters. Paul's first imprisonment would have been 60 to 63. So many of those letters were actually written from a prison cell. And then the martyrdom of Paul sometime around 67. So, I mean, he was writing these things at the end of his life. That gives you a sense of when they were written. It was during the reign of Nero in Rome, the crackpot emperor that set Rome on fire and then watched it burn and played his fiddle. So the story goes. My favorite letter is the book to the church at Rome, and in fact, it's Romans chapter 8. This is the one that talks about the creation waiting for the glory about to be revealed, for the revealing of the children of God, creation desiring to be set free from bondage. We groan inwardly, the first fruits of the Spirit we have, but we groan inwardly while we wait for adoption and redemption. The Spirit helps us in our weakness. When we don't know how to pray as we ought, the Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. If God is for us, who is against us? God intercedes. Christ intercedes to God on our behalf. What will separate us from the love of God? Hardship, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, or peril, or sword? None of these things. For we're more than conquerors. Probably some familiar lines from your Bible reading through the years. As you were looking at these books, were there any, maybe one, two, that strike you as a favorite letter? I mean, I know you're reading the epistles weekly. Were there particular passages that maybe have stuck with you? You often hear the epistles at weddings. Love is patient, love is kind, etc., etc., etc. You don't often hear admonitions from James at a wedding about bridling the tongue, but it could be sound advice. Other things that stick out to you?
This didn't come out of the Bible, but on the way to church this morning, I was just looking at this Philippi here. It says, this is Paul's happiest letter, that he is happy. Yeah. There's a car beside me, a license plate said, I am happy. And the car wasn't moving very fast, and these were senior citizens, much more senior than myself. And I thought, what a great thing to say every day and to let everybody see. So
yeah.
He obviously wasn't a prisoner, but, you know, if Paul could be happy in prison,
yeah,
and that's some kind of strength.
And Paul loved these churches like children. He helped to birth these churches. And so when they had failings, he felt those failings like a parent might feel the failings of a child. And you find those expressions of great love and affection in his greetings at the beginning of the letters and at the closing of the letters as well. And he was dealing with churches in very, very different settings. You had the Ephesians and the giant temple of the goddess Artemis. There was an entire trade, an economy built around worship of Artemis. You had people making miniature idols. You could think of it as like a religious tourist stop. There were temple prostitutes. The worship at the temple was not orderly. And so you hear Paul in these places where pagan worship is prevalent talking about order in worship. Those speeches about order are where you get the women having their head covered and men being the only ones to speak. And like I said, Paul did not necessarily expect that these would be the end-all and be-all for all time. He was writing to a church in a specific situation. Now, there's been a lot of debate around whether head coverings should still remain and whether women should teach and preach and talk in the church. My opinion is that Paul was speaking very specifically to a context where he felt like the church needed to be looking different and living differently than the pagan culture around it. You'll hear a variety of perspectives on that, but I think it's important to look at the context.
Isn't it interesting that we have so many different churches that function so differently, not only denominationally, but within our denomination, and we're okay with that. We get that.
Yeah.
What works here doesn't necessarily work at another Mennonite congregation, and yet we allow for that diversity.
Yeah, ideally, with the diversity among churches, we do allow grace for each other. There are always exceptions. But, you know, for the largest part, I think congregations do what they do, and in many ways are going to be different. Certainly worship styles are different. Understandings of Scripture, focus on Scripture.
But they even their constitutions, how they function.
Oh, sure.
They relate to one another.
Yeah, church functions, you bet. Some churches may not have a formal constitution or a very basic one that incorporates them as a nonprofit so they can have documentation. Some churches don't have budgets. They just say on a given Sunday morning, this is going to go to XYZ mission effort, and the next Sunday this is going to go to the pastor's salary, and it's taken on faith that all the needs are going to be met. Hopefully on mortgage and utilities Sunday there's good giving.
Pastor salaries,
I would rally for a good offering on that day. The Gospels then were written after the letters to the churches. And you had the original disciples having perhaps passed away already or getting quite aged. And so making sure to capture their testimony, either those that were directly related to the apostles or those who had received reports of the stories were able to get those down in written form and collect them so that they would be preserved. Sort of like when grandparents are nearing the end and suddenly the family realizes we got to get this stuff down because so much is stored in their head or we're going to lose information about our family. You know, it's the same kind of thing. In prior weeks, it was talked about that Mark was probably the first gospel that was written, and Matthew and Luke draw from what's in Mark. They have individual things that they add or alter different ways of telling stories. You might find Feeding of the 5,000 to be a long exposition or a very short one, and other things. John is a completely different bird. John was a gospel that was written with a theological interpretation in mind. Theologian Jürgen Moltmann always talked about the Jesus in John like Jesus floated a few inches off the ground. That the divinity and sonship and authority of Jesus were so prominent that, you know, he, more than the other Gospels, he just floated slightly above the ground in John's take. And there was a community that formed around John. Scholars call it the Johannine community. So the letters of John later in the New Testament were likely written by this community that were disciples of John. You hear a lot of echoing of themes, light and darkness, rejection by those that God sent the word into the world. You hear that language mirrored in both places. And this is jumping quite a ways ahead, but Revelation probably was written before the Gospels. During the reign of Nero, when the church was undergoing persecution, Revelation was a book that was written to provide hope for the churches. And you see at the beginning of Revelation, there are short letters to churches. To the church at da-da-da-da-da, a welcome admonition kind of thing, like an epistle in a paragraph. I would like, as an exercise this morning, a little different than normal, to have you just draft some a few points as if you were writing a letter to the Mennonite Church of Normal. And if some of you want to make them illuminated and do illustrations or calligraphy, you're certainly welcome to. Thank you. The first part is always the greeting. There's commonly an expression of affection, note of hearing about the good things that are going on. So take just a minute or two and jot down a couple of points that you would include in a greeting to the Mennonite Church of Normal. And then after your greeting, I'd like you to report two or three good things that you've heard are going on, with a little more detail than you might have mentioned in the greeting. And hopefully you have ample things to cite. And then I'd like you to note a challenge that exists in the congregation and give admonishment to the congregation to find a way to figure it out. Admonishment being, in a severe way, scolding, finger wagging. And while you're admonishing, toss in a little sprinkle of encouragement. And I'd like you to end with an expression of affection, blessing, and a conclusion. Not surprising, the conclusion comes at the end. For those of you that are comfortable sharing, I'd like to hear some of the content of your letters. How did you greet the church at Normal? The danger in making eye contact with the teacher is being called on. Yes, Eric.
I'll start it off.
All right.
I just said your work in the community, and I use quotes around community because it's not just a community of Bloomington Normal, but it's the church community,
yeah,
the broader church, is life-giving and at times amazing.
Work in the community is at times life-giving and amazing. Or life-giving and sometimes amazing.
What? And at times amazing.
And at times amazing. Hopefully it's always life-giving. What about the noting of good things?
I just wrote, it's good to hear of your love for one another, Jesus Christ, and the world.
Okay, love for one another, Jesus Christ, and the world. You're sounding Pauline.
Very generous of our gifts and very caring.
Okay, generous with gifts and caring and giving.
Increasing numbers, lots of young children.
Okay, growth in numbers and multiplication of children.
And strong encouragement for our young people to attend church camp.
Okay, so formation in faith of young people. And what about the admonition? What's a challenge that the church faces that you addressed?
That you, I hear that year after year, at the end of the year, you haven't quite met your budget.
Oh. I hear that year after year, you come to the end of the year having not met your budget expenses with giving.
It's good that the congregation has a vibrant worship service, but it's getting longer and longer, and as a result, we aren't able to visit, or we're cutting short on the Sunday school time. So I would admonish them to start the church service a half hour earlier, and so that we can have our hour and a half service, and then have a half hour to visit, and then have full Sunday school.
Now you're sounding really Pauline, because you're giving an earth-shattering admonition that that would activate many people, I imagine. Though a half an hour seems a small thing. So starting worship earlier, because though vibrant worship keeps going longer and longer and diminishing fellowship time and full time in Sunday school.
You got it.
Okay.
React to his. So I agree with the issue. I'm not sure I agree with the solution. And I think, well, I'm not picking on Ron specifically, but I think it's true with even the letters, where as you said, sometimes those solutions are taken out of context and tried to apply a specific solution. So the issue may be agreed upon, but how we go about solving it, there's a multitude of ways.
Yeah.
I don't want to get here earlier when we already have to get here earlier for quite. You know,
yeah.
But it's kind of it's a good example of it.
So you're saying that you could see congregations splitting over the issue of when to start church.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
You see that?
Because Paul said half an hour earlier.
Well, and I hope to God that this is an exception, but there was a story in the news Friday, I think it was, where someone had gone to a church and they sat in a seat that was reserved for someone else. There was an argument. The person was asked to leave the seat, and then another party came up with a handgun. Said that he hoped to de-escalate the situation, ended up shooting the guy and killing him, the guy who sat in the wrong seat. That's an extreme example.
That's why Steve and I chose to mix up our seats all the time.
Yeah, you may want to be careful moving around.
Yeah, I really do. I got to know the regions.
Yeah, one thing that you don't see in the New Testament is letters written back to Paul. Dear Paul, we really like you as a guy. You're pretty nice, but we think you're full of hot air. Or
we tried it, it worked, or we tried it, it didn't work.
Yeah, no reporting of whether it worked or not.
Yeah.
So there's a piece missing. But yeah, certainly the diversity within one congregation is abundant, let alone congregations in different geographical settings and different cultures.
I wrote, remember your past, but dream of the future, and allow God's Spirit to direct your visions.
Remember the past and look to the future led by the Spirit. What about your next section in the letter?
I wrote more awareness and welcoming of diversity.
Okay, more awareness and welcoming of diversity. Certainly, depending on the definition of diversity, there is a multitude of viewpoints within not only our denomination, Mennonite Church USA, but certainly the church at large.
I was on this theme about stewardship and coming up short at the end of the year, and I said, in my letter, just imagine how wonderful it would be to have a meeting at the end of the year where instead of talking about being short, you would actually have a surplus and you could get together and decide how to use that surplus.
How wonderful it would be at the end of the year to find yourself with a surplus of giving beyond expenses and have to figure out how to be generous. Other things? Yeah.
So a couple weeks ago, Tim spoke of servant attitude and servant approach. So I echo those words and that spirit as a follow-up to my admonition to committees who have to be careful following rules and regulations of the past. Kind of going to some of the diversity that's already talked about.
Yeah. So in the midst of congregational process as fit and starty as it can be, and difficult to find ways to serve each other. What about your blessing and conclusion? Your fondness, your wishes for the congregation? Okay, God bless you in your efforts. One or two more? What do we have from first letter from Marge?
We do not all have to agree about everything, but believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus, that you are loved, that you can give and receive this. Blessings as you grow and work through any struggles, always remember it to be your choice.
Wow.
You do get a book.
Ha cha cha. So, within the diversity, remember the core things that we believe about Jesus Christ, and as you wrestle with them, may you be blessed, grace abound. Great. So you see, there's a lot of diversity among you. One of the things that is important to remember is these letters and information were being exchanged by the literal pace of a snail in the mail. You know, these were handwritten scrolls being given to somebody who might have passed it on to somebody who happened to be going to the city where the church was. And we don't know if Paul heard any responses from the churches. We know that he heard secondhand things that came back. He says, you know, I've heard such and such about you. And if he's in jail, he's not certainly visiting them personally. Yeah, and there's the risk of the letters being confiscated. We don't know if there were more letters in this that were written by Paul. These are the ones that survived. And when it came to the formation of the canon, there was a lot of debate about what should go in. There are things that were left out that are considered extra canonical. You'll find writings attributed to Peter. I think we mentioned that a few weeks ago. That's where you find the story about child Jesus turning clay pigeons into real ones. So the church had to separate out what of these things have the ring of authenticity from what we know of the witness of the apostles, what seems to be legendary or built up. Revelation was almost rejected because of its sort of mystical, apocalyptic bent. It was a common genre, but they questioned whether it should be included. And that's leaving aside the intertestamental books about the Maccabees and some of those after the Old Testament wisdom writings. They're often viewed as sort of having historical context value. Interestingly, the Anabaptists would have had those books, the Apocrypha, in their Bible. Catholics still have them in their Bible. Reformists kicked most of them out of what would come to be the Protestant Bible. Although, interestingly, some things were commonly noted as maybe a sidebar of things that could be learned or observed. Any final thoughts? We've got about 4 minutes or so until we pop out. If you're ever wanting a fresh way to read the New Testament, read the epistles and then read the Gospels and compare what kind of theological things might have informed the Gospel writings that the early church was wrestling with before they were written. Certainly, even though they're biographical, and they're trying to present details as they understood them happening, everything that's written in there has some type of audience, context, and theological perspective. There's a book by Marcus Borg, which is called The Evolution of the New Testament. And he presents the books roughly in the order that it is believed that they were written, and provide some of the context about things that the church was wrestling with and how it leads up to the Gospels and beyond. And you can find a number of books about the formation of the canon. These were a couple of seminary texts that are pretty accessible. How the Bible Came to Be by John W. Miller, and The Journey from Texts to Translations. So this goes even further into translations into other languages later on. That's Paul D. Wegner, W-E-G-N-E-R. But if you go to Amazon and look for canon formation or how the Bible came to be, you'll find some varieties. If you add an extra N to your search, formation of canons, that might be interesting. There are a lot of...
A lot more hits.
Huh? Yeah, yeah. No pun there, a lot more hits. And some of our high school and junior high boys are already interested in building backyard catapults. So if you want formation of those cannons, you might talk to them. Well, thank you for coming this morning. And the worksheets for next week are on the podium there. And have a wonderful week.